Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Biotech Podcast Insight segment, where we investigate major topics that are shaping medical treatments today. For updates about upcoming guests, follow us on social media and visit us at hopkinsbiotechpodcast.com to check out our full catalog of episodes. I'm your host, Joe Varielli.
Our guest today is Dr. Philip Kantoff. Phil is the CEO and co-founder of Convergent Therapeutics, a clinical stage pharmaceutical company focused on developing next generation radiopharmaceutical therapies for prostate and other cancers. The company's proprietary technology involves dual-targeted radionuclide therapy developed by Dr. Neil Bander, professor of urologic oncology at Weill Cornell Medicine. Prior to founding the company, Dr. Kantoff spent 6 years as the chairman of the Department of Medicine at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, caring for cancer patients and developing improved cancer testing and cancer therapies. He is the emeritus Jerome and Nancy Kohlberg Chair in Medicine at Harvard Medical School, and he was the chief of the Solid Tumor Oncology Division and director of the Lank Center for Genitourinary Oncology at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Dr. Kantoff has created robust programs of clinical care, as well as laboratory and clinical research. He is a member of numerous editorial boards and has written more than 500 articles and books. Phil, thanks so much for joining us today.
Joe, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So after rattling off your background, it's really deep and really deep in academic medicine. I'm so interested in having you on to talk about your background, but especially your transition to Convergent Therapeutics and getting into the realm of biotechnology. Can you briefly just touch on some of the points that I mentioned, your career and leadership in academic medicine and how that got you to where you are today, co-founding and running Convergent Therapeutics?
Sure, Joe. So first of all, I'm a trained medical oncologist. I did my medical school training at Brown, and then I did a long postdoctoral fellowship, actually after my fellowship, after my clinical fellowship, which was at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the NIH in molecular hematology. And following that, I went on to the staff as an instructor and then an assistant professor at the Dana-Farber at Harvard. And I was there for 28 years, Joe. And it was really a fantastic experience for me. I was partly clinician. I specialized in genitourinary cancers, specifically mostly prostate and testicular cancer. I ran a laboratory, a funded laboratory for 3 decades. And I was involved in clinical trials, early clinical trials, but also large randomized phase 3 trials. As my career advanced, I became more interested in mentorship and leadership and took on roles that you described before, including the head of solid tumor oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and then the head of clinical research at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And you know, for personal reasons, I decided to moved to New York and become the chairman of medicine at Memorial Sloan Kettering. It was just a desire that I had to take on a big leadership position. I had considered cancer center directorship jobs, considered chairman of medicine jobs, but it seemed right for me at the moment to take on that role at Memorial Sloan Kettering, which to me is one of the premier cancer centers, as is the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And I had 6 fantastic years there. I had to give up a little bit because the job was quite extensive from an administrative standpoint. Gave up a little bit on the patient care side and a little bit on the clinical research side. Continued to run my laboratory, which was focused on prostate cancer genetics, genomics, biomarkers, understanding resistance mechanisms to different therapies in prostate cancer. I accomplished a lot of my goals that I wanted to at Memorial Sloan Kettering over that 6-year period of time. And obviously, there were a lot of things that happened during that time, including COVID, which was it was quite an experience to be in a leadership position during that period of time, particularly in New York, which was struck very early and very hard during that time. And so for personal reasons, specifically, I was commuting back and forth to Boston to be with my soon-to-be wife, and then I ultimately got married. I decided to move back to Boston to be with her. And there was an interval of time between making that decision, COVID, and moving back to Boston, where I considered different career paths. Having been in academia for 35 years and having accomplished a lot of the goals that I wanted to accomplish academically, I really enjoyed patient care, enjoyed leadership. I looked around at academic opportunities for a brief period of time. I made fairly early a decision that I would leave academic medicine when I moved back to Boston. And I considered positions in pharma and positions in biotech. And what drew me to biotech was the, and particularly a startup biotech company, was the nimbleness of what a biotech company, particularly a startup, can be, the camaraderie that's developed amongst people that you hire and develop, and creating a vision of which direction we should go in. So I had never really been, although I had been involved in clinical research, never had been a drug developer per se, where you take something from the laboratory and develop it all the way to clinical approval. So going into the company Convergent, which you mentioned before, which is the company that I lead, was a new, different type of experience for me with regard to the type of science, the type of experience it was going to be for me. Very exciting. And I've spent the past year leaning on some of the skills that I developed as a physician scientist over the years, leading on my experience as a leader, but learning a lot about how to run a biotech company, which has been a fantastic learning experience for me.
Yeah. And I look forward to talking about some of the technical aspects of what Convergent is developing. I wanted to touch on one point that you had mentioned, though, in that you being at these really top academic research cancer centers were exposed to randomized clinical trials and sort of new innovations in the drug development space. And I know that you even were the lead investigator on a clinical trial of a therapeutic vaccine for prostate cancer that was eventually approved. So what was your experience like in seeing the drug development space change over time? And during your tenure was really sort of the rise of biologics. And now as a company that's developing biologic-based medicines, what did you have to change in your perspective in order to provide better care for your patients and push these molecules and medicines forward?
Right. I think it's a great question. I mean, being in the field of oncology for 35 plus years, I've seen an enormous evolution in what's available for patients. It's been incredibly rewarding seeing where we were when I started out and where we are right now. Where we were back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, we were limited for the most part to chemotherapy and hormonal therapy for the cancers that we treated. That's in addition to the typical therapies for early cancers in general, which is surgery and radiation. So we really had a very limited armamentarium in the early days of my career and certainly before that as well. And it's been extremely exciting to see how things have evolved. I think one of the, in to my memory, one of the most exciting things that happened was the development of Gleevec, which was a drug that was targeted against the tyrosine kinase mutation and was spectacularly successful in the context of chronic myelogenous leukemia, where it took it from a lethal disease to be a chronic disease. Where survival was tremendously impacted. And another great example of that, and I would call this the, you know, the era of precision medicine, was the development of Herceptin for HER2 positive breast cancer, which I think has had a huge impact in breast cancer and HER2 positive breast cancer. And that those two drug development events, which I wasn't directly involved in, but witnessed, was we all were saying, oh, wow, if we understand the genomics of a cancer, the genetics of a cancer, we will be able to cure cancer. And there was an era that followed where we developed better technologies, as you know, for sequencing tumors, and it became just more and more readily available and easier to do. And we discovered the landscape of mutations and germline abnormalities in different cancers. And I would say that it's, with a few exceptions, the recognition of Herceptin initially for HER2 positive breast cancer and Gleevec in CML, the advances in precision medicine have been fairly incremental after that. And nice advances in lung cancer, particularly EGFR, but some of the other rarer mutations than EGFR mutations. So, you know, just putting precision medicine in perspective, by my view, is it's part of the armamentarium of what we do. And it is important to sequence tumors and understand the germline. And there have been incremental benefits as a result of that. And, I'm a big advocate of precision medicine, but it has its limitations. And I think the next step has been immuno-oncology. And yes, I was involved in the vaccine trial. It's really a cell-based therapeutic for prostate cancer that was approved in 2010, a drug called Cipolusil-T. And then what followed was the recognition that checkpoint inhibitors were effective. And that was really pretty amazing advance in the early 2000, over the past decade. And in particular, diseases like melanoma, which was a lethal disease uniformly when recurrent and metastatic, where we're curing approximately half of patients with advanced disease with checkpoint blockade. And there have been notable advances in a number of other cancers, including lung cancer, kidney cancer, bladder cancer, and a number of other areas. And people have, I think that was the beginning of immuno-oncology and immunotherapy. CAR T cells followed, and big advances in pediatric leukemia and in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But I think we're still in the early days of immuno-oncology, and you're an immunologist, so you understand. I think the world is ahead of us because we're just beginning to learn the complexity of the immune system and how to harness it and try to find the other checkpoint blockers and other mechanisms that we can attack in the immune system. I think that each of these things are complementary. You know, chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, surgery, radiation, precision medicine, immuno-oncology. I think that's the way we have to look at it, and that one is not going to, in the near term, supplant everything else. So the area that I'm interested in right now, and what drew me to Convergent, was the burgeoning field of radiopharmaceuticals. And this is not a new, broadly not a new idea. Radiation has been an important modality in the treatment of cancer, you know, for over 100 years. We credit Marie Curie and others for advancing the importance of radiation, which kills cancer cells. The traditional way, Joe, of treating cancers with radiation have been directing a beam of radiation at where the cancer is, but traditionally has not been a particularly effective other than a palliative treatment for patients with advanced cancer in general. So then enters the world of radiopharmaceuticals, which allows for targeted delivery of radiation to specific areas where cancer resides. And there have been attempts at doing this in the past, which have been unsuccessful. And then there was the approval of a drug, radium-223, about 8 years ago for the treatment of prostate cancer, which was a small incremental advance in the treatment of advanced prostate cancer. It's really not very commonly used anymore because it's a little bit challenging to administer, although well tolerated. Patients don't really respond to the treatment, but they have a prolongation in survival. And it's a little challenging for physicians and patients to see that the cancer is progressing at the same time that they may get some benefit in the long term in terms of overall survival. It's a reasonable therapy, but it's not commonly used. I think 5% of patients with prostate cancer get that therapy. I think a real jolt to the field was the development of radioligand therapy. And I'm going to talk about this in a little bit more detail, Joe. There are multiple ways of delivering targeted radiation to patients. And the targeting molecules can be, I'm going to use two as an example. One is a small ligand, peptide ligand. Alternatively, you can use a full antibody. And our company, which is Convergent, focuses on antibodies as the delivery mechanism. But there was an approval earlier this year of a radioligand therapy that's directed at a specific cell surface protein known as prostate-specific membrane antigen, which is present in prostate cancer cells, much more so than in normal prostate, and very little expression of PSMA in other normal tissues. So it makes it a very good target. And there was a ligand that was developed that binds to PSMA, I'll say prostate-specific membrane antigen on the surface of prostate cancer cells, attached to a beta-emitting radiopharmaceutical known as lutetium-177. And it was developed in Europe, but advanced by Novartis, who conducted a phase three trial of this radioligand of 617 attached to lutetium-177 and demonstrated two important endpoints in cancer in general, and that's progression-free survival advantage, that is time to radiographic progression, and overall survival, which is sort of the gold standard in terms of what we look for in therapies. So what makes our technology unique is the use of antibodies and also the use of a different radionuclide. And let me focus on the radionuclide first and talk about the differences between beta particles and alpha particles. I'm sure you know this, Joe, and many listeners or know the difference, but let me just highlight it. Alpha particles are much more powerful than beta particles, probably 1,000-fold more powerful. They do not penetrate as readily as beta particles, so their path length is very narrow. And in addition to that, shielding for an alpha particle is really minimal. You can shield against an alpha particle with a sheet of paper, whereas for beta particles, you need much more intense shielding. So alpha particles allow you to deliver very precise radiation to the place where you want to deliver it. It does require attachment of the alpha particle to the cell, And it does require that the antibody conjugate gets taken up by the cell. So once it gets into the cell, it causes double strand breaks in DNA. And all you need is a single strand, a double strand break to kill a cell. So it's a very, very effective modality. And the therapeutic window for radioantibodies is very large because the off-target toxicity is quite minimal. So this area more broadly of radioligands, radioantibodies, beta particles, alpha particles is going to explode, if you will. And we are focused on developing radioantibodies, and our radioantibody is also directed at prostate-specific membrane antigen. It's attached to an alpha particle known as actinium-225. And in our early clinical trials, phase one trials, we have seen spectacular activity with regression of cancer to a, you know, fascinating degree. Even in patients who had received prior radioligand therapy directed at prostate-specific membrane antigen, which is fascinating, why it's active and, you know, why it's more active than radioligand therapy. How much of that is due to the fact that it's an antibody and is taken up and retained by the cell more than the radioligand? And how much of it is due to the fact that we're dealing with an alpha particle versus a beta particle? It isn't clear to me, but it's probably some combination of the two. So our technology is radioantibodies. We're using it first in prostate cancer. And something I didn't mention before, Joe, is we're then going to move on to treating other solid tumors. And you may ask why. And the reason is because other solid tumors, most other solid tumors, when they grow, develop a neovasculature by an angiogenesis mechanism. And for reasons that are not completely clear, the neovasculature of most solid tumors produces PSMA. So we look at that as a potential target as well for our antibody actinium conjugate. And beyond that, we are looking at other surface molecules on different types of cancers, and we are going to develop radioantibodies against these other surface molecules.
The technology is incredible, and I agree that it seems like the field of targeted radiopharmaceuticals is really having a moment. And I see it sort of analogous to another field, like antibody drug conjugates that are becoming more prominent now. And both of these modalities play into this targeted aspect of trying to reduce off-target effects and save normal cells, but really, kill and decrease the size of the tumor. So anything that we can do in solid tumors in that respect is incredible. In researching this field, I find one unique consideration in that these radioactive molecules, lutetium, actinium, they are rare and they don't seem like they're easy to synthesize. And I think from a market dynamic standpoint, it creates this sort of unique supply chain consideration when developing these therapies. So I know that Convergent has made some strategic partnerships with companies that actually make these radioisotopes. I'm wondering how that impacts your drug development pipeline and how you see development of these drugs moving forward. And how do you create those strategic partnerships to try to mitigate some of the supply chain considerations?
So I'm not an expert in this area of radionuclide development, but I can speak to it a little bit. So actinium is produced by two mechanisms. Either it's derivative from thorium isotope, And there are things called thorium cows that, blocks of thorium that turn into actinium-225. And that's one of the ways of deriving actinium-225 is from a thorium cow. The other mechanism is through a cyclotron mechanism that I, it's beyond my capabilities to describe exactly what's going on. But I believe the precursor in that is a radium isotope, which is then bombarded and turned into radium-225. So for the purposes of what we're doing at Convergent, we get our supply from the Department of Energy, which is the main supplier of actinium-225 at this point. And they traditionally have derived the actinium-225 from the thorium cow mechanism, but they are beginning to move over to the accelerated derived mechanism, and they feel comfortable, as the FDA feels comfortable with that mechanism of derivation of actinium-225. The Department of Energy is not capable, I don't believe, and it's not part of what they do to supply the world with a sufficient supply of actinium-225, although we have been early users, and I would say that we have a line with the Department of Energy because of what we have been doing. So I'm going to use the expression, we're going to hedge our bets. And people are realizing that actinium-225 is going to be an important agent in oncology in the future. So what's happening, has happened, is happening, is the development of companies that are producing actinium-225 by one of the two mechanisms that I mentioned before. And they're gearing up, and you mentioned that we have relationships that we have developed with a couple companies, Ionetics and Northstar, and they will be producing sufficient quantities of actinium-225 in 2023 and 2024. So I think, Joe, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And that is, I think people realize the importance of actinium-225, and there will be an adequate supply in the coming years to supply Convergent Therapeutics and potentially other companies with actinium-225.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I think unique to this growing field of radiopharmaceuticals. So going back to Convergent and the clinical trials that they're operating now. So you had a recent presentation at AACR. Can you talk about some of those initial data? You alluded to it earlier, but what endpoints are you looking at, and how have individuals treated with these medicines fared so far?
So just to review for you, although I know you know, phase one clinical trials are basically dose-finding experiments where you look for the maximum tolerated dose, you're looking for toxicities. Phase two trials are trials where you're extending at a specific dose and looking at activity of the drug. Phase three trials are generally randomized control trials, looking for more solid clinical endpoints, like, as I mentioned before, radiographic progression-free survival and overall survival. So we're somewhere in that phase one, phase two period of doing phase one clinical trials to try to find the optimal dose. Now, just a little bit of information that the traditional way of finding optimal dose in oncology is with what's called a 3+3 design, where you put patients at a certain dose on the clinical trial, you look for toxicity. And if you see, some toxicity at that dose, then you add more patients on at that particular dose. And if you don't see more toxicity, I'll say, you then move up to the next dose. So this is the 3+3 design. The FDA has looked at this carefully over the past 30 years and said, I think we need to do a better job in general at dose finding. And I do believe that I think they're right in the saying that we need to refine our doses, if not go as far as to individualize dosing based on the patient. That would be challenging, but nonetheless optimal. And this is not specific for radiopharmaceuticals. This is true for immunotherapies, targeted therapies, precision medicine, chemotherapy, et cetera. So I think we're in a new age of understanding optimal dose in patients. But getting back to our trials, what's fascinating about convergence trials is that in phase one clinical trials, which are generally toxicity, dose finding experiment, we found fantastic activity of our compound, what we call Convo1 alpha, which is antibody actinium. So in our first study of just giving one dose to patients, dose escalation, as I mentioned before, 45% of patients had a significant response, which is really quite remarkable. And it's eye-popping for a lot of people that look at it. And we've then gone on to do multi-dosing, multiple doses, and we're able to give a higher dose than we had given in the single dose experiment cumulatively. And it's not, the study is not finished and it's not published or presented yet, so I can't give you details, but I will say that the data is even more profound in terms of responses and tolerability. The study that you're alluding to that was presented at the AACR meeting in April was a combination trial combining the radio antibody with the radio ligand using an alpha particle, beta particle, using an antibody ligand, where you can derive multiple levels of synergy because antibodies work differently than ligands. Alpha particles work differently than beta particles. And the biodistributions of alpha, of antibodies and ligands are non-overlapping. So there's non-overlapping toxicity. And what I can tell you is that the early results of that trial are also quite, you know, once again, a phase one dose escalation trial, trying to find dose, optimal dose in the combination. You know, 8 out of 9 patients that were presented at AACR responded to the combination. That trial is still open and accruing patients. So our early results in phase one, which will need to be expanded, really are quite dramatic. And we're very optimistic that our first agent, which is Convo1 alpha, will move toward a registration trial within the next year or so.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it allows me to transition to my final question. Given what we had talked about for combination strategies and your really nice description of how we've been able to amass sort of a toolkit of different modalities over time as more drugs are developed, how do radiopharmaceuticals fit into that toolkit? And where do you see that in the future in working with other drugs that are effective against a number of types of cancer?
I think it's a great question. You know, I right now, what I would say is we can look at these radiopharmaceuticals both as monotherapies as well as in combinations. When you use combinations, you have to start from scratch again and do phase one studies and test the tolerability of combinations. One of those combinations I just mentioned to you, and that is with a radioligand and a radioantibody. But there are other opportunities with DNA damaging agents or DNA repair agents. So you can imagine that combining a PARP inhibitor or other inhibitors of DNA repair with a molecule that does damage to DNA would be a really quite an interesting experiment. And we're planning to do that. In addition, in the context of prostate-specific membrane antigen, the combination of hormonal therapy with radioantibody therapy in vitro or preclinically is synergistic because reducing androgen increases the expression of prostate-specific membrane antigen. So you have more targets and therefore potentially more sites that can be bound by antibody. So that's a potential area that we're pursuing. Ultimately, what Joe, where we want to go with this particular agent is in early disease, where we move from the, I'll say, life prolonging kind of therapy to a curative therapy. And we do believe aspirationally that if you treat patients with agents like radioantibodies early in the context of recurrent disease or in the adjuvant setting, which is post-radiation, post-surgery, we might be able to cure patients that otherwise would die of their disease.
Yeah, and I think that really that makes sense. And if the safety profile continues to be optimistic, then I think that's a really great way to look at it. Yeah, I really appreciate you joining us today and talking to us about your deep experience in clinical and academic medicine and leadership and where Convergent Therapeutics is going in the next few years.
Joe, thanks so much for the opportunity to talk to you and your audience, and best of luck to you.
Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to follow Hopkins Biotech Podcast on social media at Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter for updates about upcoming guests. And visit us at hopkinsbiotechpodcast.com to check out our full catalog of episodes. I'm Joe Varielli. Thank you for listening.